part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
Welcome to the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name, as always, is Christian Horn, and I have on the line a writer of many things. Carlo, you're going to help me with your last name. I want to make sure I don't mispronounce it.
Oh, okay. So my professional name is Carla Nappi.
Okay.
But my married name is Carla Gedecky.
Okay. Okay. Well, so we'll go with either one. That's fine. That's fine. I'll call you Nappi for now. We should sort of like cut right to the chase. The reason we have you on this podcast is because you have a Kickstarter.
Comic book.
Yeah, a comic book, but also a Kickstarter happening, correct?
Yes.
Yes, and it's going on right now. It's almost funded, right? Correct. I just checked.
Very close. I think we're at 91% the last time I checked.
That's awesome. Congratulations. You're getting there. I'm sure by the time this airs, which will probably be like Monday, this coming Monday, you will be fully funded and not have needed to even do this interview. So, but why don't we let the people know what the Kickstarter comic book is? Because people may not know, and I'm sure they would like to know what they need to throw their money at.
So the Kickstarter is for the first two issues of my comic book Duplicant, mm-hmm. which is set in the future during a pandemic of organ failure and focuses on the scientist who becomes a victim of his own technology.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We have the first two issues completely done, so the Kickstarter is for printing purposes to get the hard copies into people's hands, and if anything that we raise over our goal is going to go towards the art for issue three.
Awesome, awesome. Yeah, yeah. I actually read both of them this morning, and I have to say I really enjoyed it. I mean, I think this is a really, really solid book. I mean, it's beautiful looking. I love the idea. I love the concept, especially with what's going on in the news right now with a creepy Chinese virus invading yep. our shores. So, yeah, it kind of like hit the nail on the head. Wherever could you have found your inspiration?
I know, you just have to kind of stumble on anything lately with the way all the weird viruses keep coming out of the woodwork.
Yeah. It's actually one of my, I'm a child of the 80s, so one of my big sort of like fears, nightmares is like nuclear apocalypse, pandemic, you know, end of the world sort of thing. Those are the things that still keep me up at night. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. As a fellow child of the 80s, that's probably what influenced me as well.
Yeah. So how did you, because I found the whole sort of, the whole, I guess, disease condition thing that develops to be very original, like an organ failure pandemic, where it seems to me, at least, you know, having read the first two issues, it seems like that whatever disease happens, it actually attacks certain organs and causes critical organ failure, correct?
Exactly. That's exactly what happens. And you don't know which organ it's going to hit. So uh-huh. for someone, it could be their heart. For someone else, it could be their lungs. Someone else, it could be their liver.
Sure. And so, yeah, I mean, that was definitely sort of just the question that popped into my head. I mean, if it's your liver or a kidney, you know, would it be both kidneys? You know, I mean, could a person sort of survive this, an attack on this? Or is it always sort of failure, like systematic just failure?
You mean as far as like the body as a whole or just the organ that gets...
Well, just like if it's a kidney, there's always another kidney, right? Or, you know, I'm saying like, or would it take out both kidneys? Because in the case of the first book, we obviously meet a young woman who, you know, not to spoil anything, has a critical failure of her lungs, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So I would imagine that it would be like a enough of an organ failure that it's going to kill you, correct?
Exactly.
Not just disable you.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like, where did this, I mean, I don't know, it sounds like a stupid question to ask a writer, but where did sort of the idea, what made you hone in on actual sort of organ failure? Is there something like a family history or something like that that sort of made it pop up, or?
Well, I do have a history of kidney cancer in my family, definitely played a part in this.
Sure.
And then I was also inspired by the movie Repo: The Genetic Opera, which deals with organ failure.
Okay.
And at the time when I came up with the idea, there was a lot in the news about nanotechnology and how they were trying to figure out the printing of organs, which is still obviously in the works. But I kind of just kind of combined all those things together to come up with this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's very interesting because I'm also sort of obviously a guy into comics and into sci-fi and the future and stuff like that. And there's definitely some sequences in this book where you see people actually having organs printed. And I found that to be like amazing because that's sort of what a lot of people see as the next step for like 3D printing, correct?
Yeah. So in my book, the idea is that they can't figure out a vaccine to stop this disease. So the scientist, Matt Travers, comes up with this way to duplicate them. And that also gets rid of the need for, when you get an organ now, you have to have these medications you take for the rest of your life to prevent rejection.
Sure.
In this world, you don't need those medications. But what I thought would be the way that he overcame the issues with printing is the vascularity. That's like a big thing, because if you look at a liver or kidneys, there's so many veins that go into it, and that's a big issue that they're having, is figuring out basically the veins, the vascular system of these organs to keep them going.
Oh, wow. I mean, that's really fascinating. Also we should say that in this future, organ donation is outlawed, correct?
Exactly. So the company wanted to maximize profits, so they were able to lobby for human organs to be criminalized. So you can't, you know, say your kid is sick and you're a donor match, they won't let you donate your kidney to your kid.
Yeah. That's insane. That is frighteningly insane and sort of like on the nose for everything that's kind of happening with lobbyists in Washington. And not to get too political, but obviously health insurance and all that stuff. That was the one thing that I found to be like, I mean, really, really frightening in this book was the whole thing of like, oh, we can't donate kidneys or, you know, other organs to other people, even if we wanted to, because at first when I was reading the book, I thought it was because of the fear of like cross infection or, you know, if somebody was to donate an organ, how do we know that they're not infected? But then sort of as the whole thing goes on, and as you just stated, it's because of sort of big industry, you know, medical industry sort of stepping in and being like,
And they played on those fears that you just said as reasons why the government should make them illegal.
Sure.
So that is part of what they kind of leaned into, because there's always going to be the fear factor in things like this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And were you sort of, when you sort of came up with this idea, or have you always been sort of like a fan of like sci-fi? Because I get a very, even though it's not exactly like sort of like a Blade Runner future, but the look of the book and the sort of feel, it feels a little bit Blade Runner-y to me. And there's a little bit of like Gattaca in there and stuff. Are you a fan of that sort of thing?
Blade Runner is one of my all-time favorite movies. Ah. I probably watched it about a million times when I was probably way too young to be seeing a movie like that when it used to play on. I would think it was probably like WPIX or something like that back
in
the day.
Yeah. Oh wow. Yeah. Or Channel 9, one of the two.
Yeah, exactly. Channel 9 or 11.
Yeah, yeah. That's so great. That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I definitely got a feel, so hopefully that's a bit of a compliment. I mean, I really, Yeah, I definitely got like a really good sense of like nearby future. You know, we're sort of like going to get there, but we're not quite there yet. But to me, it was eerily closer than I wanted it to be, if that makes any sense.
Well, that's awesome. That's exactly what I was going for.
That's great. That's great. I know that you're also a writer of TV and all that sort of thing. And I mean, you go on your Kickstarter video, you talk a little bit about how you got into comic books. But I mean, let's just go even further back than that. How did you get into writing? Like, how did you discover writing? What made you sort of be like, I want to be a writer and have a career doing that?
The first person who told me I could write was my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. McKinley. We wrote a little short story, and she told me I had talent as a writer. And actually, even before that, in kindergarten, there was a poem I wrote about my dress.
Oh, that's that great.
That got picked to be published in the annual little book that they did for my grade school. So I think it was all those things kind of leading me towards it. And I wrote like a little book on my own at home. Cause it's funny. Everyone in my family draws. My whole family is full of artists, and I really can't draw.
Okay.
To save my life. I just have such trouble figuring out perspective and everything else. So my way into the arts was through writing.
No, that's great. I mean, and so you're in fourth grade and your teacher tells you you've got talent, and from that point on, were you just like, I'm going to write?
I think it more planted the kernel of the idea that it was something I should do. So okay. I think that's, if I'm remembering correctly, because it was a little bit ago, that's what made me start to write my own little short story at home.
Uh-huh.
So my parents are still trying to kind of guide me towards the art aspect, because that's what they knew. My dad's a graphic artist. His uncle did the Nancy Drew and Hardy Boy covers, those famous covers from long ago, Rudy Nappy.
Oh, wow.
You know, his whole family's artists. My mom does a lot of art. So I don't think they totally knew what to make of the writing stuff. So I didn't really delve into it heavily until, I would say, college. So it was always kind of there in the background, but I didn't really delve into it until college.
Oh, wow. Okay. So yeah, I mean, that's fantastic. And was it always sort of like TV writing or movie writing or that sort of thing? Or were you like into novels? Like what sort of, because I know you wrote for Suits, correct? According to your...
I did. I wrote an episode of Suits. I started out doing comedy, actually. My first internship was at Spin City the last year that it was filming in New York before Michael J. Fox left the show and they moved it to LA.
Oh, okay.
Fun fact, when I moved to LA the first time I lived out there, I ended up at the same lot that Spin City was shooting at.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. I wasn't on that show. I was on Third Rock from the Sun at that point.
Oh.
But it was funny that like I went from my college internship on Spin City and the show moved to LA and I ended up on the same lot that they were on. But yeah, I started doing comedy a lot because I thought I was going to be a stand-up comedian at some point in my life. So that's part of my writing too, is I did comedy writing. And then I realized that drama was more where I'm at because my sense of humor is very corny.
Okay.
So I don't think that really translates into a wide audience when you have a super corny sense of humor.
Well, explain super corny sense of humor, because I want to know, if you can, I want to know what that means. So I don't.
Things that make me laugh are insanely stupid jokes, like a man walks into a bar and says, ouch.
So kind of like what my daughter would call dad jokes. In your case, it would be mom jokes.
What's that?
that sort of thing. That's great. I mean, that was funny. It made me laugh. But yeah, I see where you're going with that. So when it came to sort of your first comic and sort of be bouncing back and forth, you didn't ever think of like, hey, I'll do like a humor book or anything?
No, I've never considered doing a humor book. And I actually was into my stand-up stuff for a long time. I had done a couple of different talent shows when I was younger. One of them was at camp, and I got really good audience reactions from it. But I just ultimately, that wasn't where I ended up going. I ended up getting into the drama writing.
Sure, sure, sure. Was there ever a particular sort of point where you realized, I mean, obviously there had to be, right? Where you realized like, okay, I've got to switch gears and move over into drama. Was there anything that sort of inspired you to do that? Or was it just, you know, let's try this?
I'm trying to think back. I know my college feature teacher was part of that, was part of what got me into that. And then my ideas all tend to be pretty dark.
Okay.
Which that isn't necessarily an issue with comedy, especially these days. But back when I was first starting to go delve into what my ideas really were, people didn't really get into the dark humor the way they do now.
Sure.
So it just seemed to lend itself more to drama than to a bunch of jokes.
Yeah. It's interesting because you're talking about comedy and, you know, Duplicant is very sort of straightforward, like future drama and stuff like that. And there is a little bit of me that's surprised to be like, hey, I was into comedy writing and stuff like that.
Yeah, I would say it's funny because most people who meet me in person, they think that I'm a fairly happy-go-lucky person, and I'm not.
Oh, really?
So when they read my writing, they go, where did that come from? That's not the person that you're coming across as.
Oh, wow, really? Oh, yeah. So you've kind of got like sunshine on the outside and darkness on the inside. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, my friends who know me, they know that I'm more of the drama person. But I think if you met me at like an interview or, you know, you were working with me, then you wouldn't necessarily know that I tend to go in for these darker pieces.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, just speaking to you now for these several minutes, I do have to say you have a very sort of sunny disposition as of right now. I'm not detecting sort of like the inner goth, but if you say it's there, I will believe you. But yeah, I mean, it must be there because Duplicant is kind of a, I don't want to say it's a downer because it's not. I don't want to discourage people from contributing to this book or checking it out or reading it or something like that. But it is very a little bit heavy at times.
Yeah, it was funny. My editor on the first issue, Vince Hernandez, who is at Aspen Comics, he's their editor at Aspen, and he writes himself a bunch of different comic books. And he just had a book come out now, Syria Pimp Hustler. I'll have to double check the name on that.
Okay.
But when he read the script for Duplicant, because it was before I even had an artist on board, he was nice enough to actually read the script for the comic book. He was like, you need a moment of humor in here. he's like, you need a moment of humor. So there's one page in the book where I have humor, where one of my characters is trying to get her automatic shower to work and it's not cooperating with her. And she's talking about singing to her science work. So that was my moment of trying to add a little bit of levity into the seriousness of the book.
Sure. So, I would love to hear a little bit more about, I mean, obviously it's all in the headlines, we're surrounded by it and all that stuff, but how sort of the inspiration for Duplicant sort of arose. I mean, you know, that sort of thing, this whole idea of like, I mean, it feels a bit dystopian, but I don't want to say that it is because I mean, obviously people are walking around. It's not Mad Max. You know, we're not all wearing leather mohawks and stuff like that. I mean, leather and mohawks. But I mean, it is sort of a very kind of morose look at where we're going. I'm just assuming that you were inspired by current events and that sort of thing.
I would say, I mean, when I first came up with the idea, it was when I was working at Suits, and that, I want to say it was 2013, 2012, when I first came up with the kernel of this idea, and Minority Report is one of my all-time favorite movies, and that was a huge, heavy influence on me as well, especially the look that I went for, because that's a dystopian movie, but people are walking around, but they're clearly not happy with the way their lives are going in that movie, and I think that's what's happening in Duplicant, too, because you lose a lot of the control over what you want to do with your life if you become sick, and who knows if you're going to become sick. You don't have... There's no way to prevent becoming sick.
Sure.
So I wanted to come up with something really unique that delved into my love of sci-fi. And I just started looking at different news article headlines, because when I worked in TV, that was what we did a lot, was if we wanted to come up with an idea, we would just read all the news until something sparked and came up with an idea. So I just started to read all these science articles to see if I could find something that fit what I wanted to do, which was Minority Report / Repo Men. And that's when I started to like learn more about the nanotechnology and what they were trying to do with organs. And it just kind of all gelled together into this idea.
Yeah. I mean, it's, to me, it's really amazing how well thought out the whole thing is, because the thing that shocked me in the beginning is because you figure it's sort of like a future society, right? And at first, upon reading it, I'm like, oh, they've got this disease, okay, whatever. And but they figured out a way to deal with it, in which, you know, they're making I'll just use the term fake organs, you know, replacements for things that fail. And my initial thought was, oh, okay, you know, they're just giving them to people like an idiot. Like, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, sure. They're just gonna take care of people and make sure that they have it. But the thing that's revealed early on is, no, you, if you have this procedure, and it also seems like maybe there's not much choice left to you whether you can have the procedure or not, like if you can say no to it. And then if you have this procedure, you have to be able to afford the procedure. And if you can't, you're saddled with debt. And I'll kind of let you take it from there, as long as it's not spoiling anything.
Yeah, so you don't have a choice, because in this world, which I think is similar to the world we're in now, if you're facing death, if your only option is death, if they don't do whatever the procedure is, the medical community is going to err towards keeping you alive.
Sure.
So that's kind of what the feeling is and the mandate is in this world, especially since human organs are criminalized. There really is no other option for you. It's not like you can go on dialysis because your kidneys just don't work at all, you know, and there's no other option because Pamela's lungs have failed. So if she doesn't get a new set of lungs, she's not going to survive.
Sure.
So yeah, if you don't have enough money, which the majority of the population is not going to have the money for this, then you're auctioned off, and whoever purchases your debt gets to employ you however they want. Now, there's supposed to be restrictions on what they can do. So in the case of Pamela, what they ultimately end up making her do, they're not supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. But as we see, it happens even now, you know, a lot of the things that aren't supposed to happen in this world, they just kind of happen because people with the money and the power tend to do whatever the heck they want at times.
Yeah. You're absolutely, I mean, you're not wrong. Look at what's happening now. No, I mean, I mean, I found it really fascinating as I was reading how much the book sort of challenged what I had already presumed was going to happen or what was going on. And I think that that speaks to you and your artist, to the strength of the book, you know, how strong it is. Because I was really impressed as I kept reading, like, oh, this kind of didn't go the way I expected it to go, or this is not the society that I thought, you know, I mean, because you figure like a future that figures out how to sort of manage a pandemic like that, you know, would sort of want to be, you know, you would think that it would be sort of like a caring sort of idyllic sort of society, but that's not what happens at all.
No, but the people in charge would tell you that that's what they are doing.
Sure.
Because, you know, people in charge, especially when they have a lot of money, they tend to just want to present their own view of things. They're never going to have to worry about this because they have enough money that where they would never have to deal with this. But they think that they're like, well, we're keeping you alive. We're saving your life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's definitely the sort of thing too, that struck me. I mean, my assumption is that this is taking place in the United States, and it's definitely not sort of like a socialized medicine society. Do you think like in future storylines or that sort of thing that we would see like what happened in Europe, or is socialized medicine still a thing because of the pandemic, or is it all gone? Does that make any sense?
Yes. In this world, the way this is set in America, but in this future world, my idea is that everything, I mean, unlike what's happening with Brexit, it's kind of, everyone's kind of under one big umbrella. The medicine and the duplicate organs are universal because the pandemic is worldwide.
Sure.
So that's another way that they're able to really monetize this in a big way.
Sure. Wow. Yeah. I mean, that was definitely a thing that kind of like hit me, because I was very much like, wait, we've gotten to the point where we can just replace organs, but we're still treating people like crap. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh no. I mean, come on.
And that's what really frustrates Matt, the scientist, because, you know, he went into this, without giving away what happens in issue two, he went into this with good intentions.
Sure.
And wanting to help people. And so when he sees his work being perverted in this way, because, you know, when you work for company, your work is work for hire. So you don't really, once you put it out there, you don't really have control over what they do with it. You can bulk all you want, but there's very little you can usually do to rustle it back. So
yeah, and nobody's donating the polio vaccine or anything like that, right?
Exactly. That's why he's so desperate to try to figure out a vaccine.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of like really great ins and outs. One of the things in particular that I love too, and again, I keep saying without spoiling anything, but you know, to the point of where it gets a little ridiculous, but I really liked the way you sort of wove religion into it as well, because or a religious groups and that sort of thing, or because they sort of come across, I mean, they are in a way a cultish sort of thing, but in the same way, they're kind of the good guys. Am I right about that? Like,
they want to be the good guys.
Yeah.
But their relationship is going to be complicated. They want to be the good guys, but they're also the bad guys.
Sure.
So they're going to straddle both realms going forward.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I found so interesting, is because obviously they are sort of for, you know, the human donation of organs, but the way that they're approaching it is kind of in a creepy, like, you know, don't come near me kind of way, right?
Well, they're approaching it from, what they're doing is they're sometimes having volunteers who will sacrifice their lives to provide healthy organs.
Yeah.
But they're also doing it from the standpoint of, you know, they might be taking people off the streets who might be disadvantaged to take their organs.
Sure.
If they're running low.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was definitely a bit in there that I really enjoyed, was sort of like mixing that in. And I'm always sort of fascinated with future stories where it's like, yeah, how does religion react to this sort of thing, you know, because obviously it's such a presence in our world. And like, if we were to discover alien life forms, like, doesn't that just throw everything out the window, you know? And so if we're getting to the point of where we can manufacture our own body parts, how does that affect the way the religious community sees everything, right?
Exactly. And that's that, and it ties in closely with Matt, because I don't think this really gives anything away, but his mentor, who he worked with at Regenerous Tech, ends up becoming a religious fanatic and ends up heading up the black market for the human organs.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you're writing for TV, or you're working on TV and stuff like that. And so what makes you want to, and people might get offended by this question, what makes you want to slum it in comics? Because I think it's so funny to me, because so many people that I interview, or so many people that I run into conventions, so many, you know, they are solely developing their sort of property as a way to get into TV or movies and stuff like that. And I'm sure that, you know, this would make a great movie or series or something like that. Like, I could easily see it on, like, Netflix or, you know, something to that, you know, like that. But what makes you go, hey, I'm working in TV, let's do comic books, like that sort of thing?
Well, I did initially come up with this idea as a pilot script.
Sure.
And I was looking for a way to make myself stand out from the crowd of newbie writers trying to get hired in a room.
Sure.
And so I had been going to conventions, and I was starting to really fall in love with this medium of comic books, which I still don't understand how I wasn't exposed to comics when I was growing up. It sure. seems like something I should have been exposed to, and yet I wasn't.
Yeah.
It was kind of like I was aware of them and I knew about them, but I was never brought to a comic book store. It wasn't something I ever was ever put in my hands to read, and none of my friends, at least as far as I knew, were reading them.
Sure.
So once I started kind of going to the conventions more and just learning more about the comic book world, I went, well, I can't write this without knowing how to write it.
Sure.
So that's what led me to find a class to learn how to write comic books, and that's what led me to Meltdown Comics. And I thought initially that I was just going to do a one-off comic book to help me with my pilot script, but I quickly fell in love with the way you write this medium. It's such a challenging and awesome way to write that I was like, this is what I need to do more of. This is what I need to do, and I'm going to make, instead of just doing this as a one-off, you know what? I'm just going to develop it as its own comic book series.
Sure.
And so I made sure to go to as many conventions as I could so I could learn about every role that goes in to making a comic book. Because when I talk to my friends and coworkers or whoever about comics, they really have no idea how many people go into making a book.
Sure.
They're always fascinated by that.
Yeah.
And then I took the writing classes, and I've got this great group of friends that we all workshop our scripts together with, Ryland Grant, Stephen Prince, and Jeff Leeds. So anything that we write, so I've seen like every issue that Ryland's done of Aberrant and Banjax.
Oh, that's great.
Before they were drawn. So I've seen all the scripts and all the other, he's got like a million series he's working on. So I've seen every script for every comic book series he's done.
Sure.
And given notes on them, and same with Steve with all of his for Monster Matador, and Jeff, and they've read all of my stuff too. My comic book, my kids book, my pilot scripts, they read it all.
Oh, that's great. That's great that you have that sort of community to fall back on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Awesome. So I guess this springs to mind like a bunch of different questions, which is A, how did you get started going to conventions? That's sort of like, I mean, it's not like one day somebody just goes, I'm going to go to a comic book convention, without sort of somebody either dragging them along or, you know what I'm saying? Do you remember what your first convention was? Do you remember what it was like?
Oh, okay. I do. It was WonderCon, mm-hmm. and it was a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
Want to say 2012 or 2013.
Okay.
Somewhere around there. One of my friends, one of my very best friends, was speaking on a panel, and she asked me to come along. So we drove there one day, and she went on her panel. It was the first time I'd ever gone. She'd been trying to get me to come to San Diego Comic-Con for years and years and years. She was like,
God.
Dude, you're going to love this. Why aren't you going? And I was like, I was stupid because, of course, like the first time I went, I was like, what have I done? Why didn't I go to this all my life?
Yeah.
She was like, this is your people. She's like, you don't understand. These are your people. So I went to WonderCon and I loved it.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to San Diego Comic-Con when I was working on Bates Motel because they had a panel there.
Yeah.
And so we all went to that, and that was my second convention I had ever gone to. Oh, and God. Then I was just like, this is it. Like, this is my people.
What was it about sort of WonderCon? I mean, had you been interested in like sort of like, you know, for lack of a better term, geeky, nerdy things? Like, what was it?
Yeah. Totally.
Okay.
Totally. Which is why it was completely stupid that I had resisted going to these conventions.
Sure,
before.
Sure. Yeah, no, it sounds like, you know, it's interesting to me because it sounds like you found everything right when you were supposed to find it. Because I know that, you know, we were talking a little earlier and we said like child of the 80s. And it's funny because several years ago with my wife, when there were still Borders around, those were bookstores, kids, in case you didn't know.
I remember Borders.
Yeah, Borders. I used to go there all the time because they would give you like a 20%, 30% discount coupons. They would just email them to you. And so then I would run to Borders and get like a manga or a graphic novel or something like that. But I remember being in a Borders with my wife and looking down sort of like the comic book aisle and seeing like all these like teenage girls and being like, that did not exist when I was a kid. And the, you know, it just didn't happen. Like women, girls did not, you know, or even pretty girls did not read comic books, you know, like I was just stunned. And I think the sort of thing is like when we were growing up, assuming that you're generally around the same age as I am, the only thing, there weren't a lot of things available that might have been appealing to your gender. Hopefully I'm not making a big sweeping statement, but I know that other than some X-Men books, you know, any girls or women that I introduced comics to were just like, yeah, this is all just women with big boobs and, you know, I'm not into it. Am I making any sort of sense?
Yes. I mean, I would say that there, of course, there's always going to be people who don't want to read the books because they see the way they make the female characters look, which isn't always appealing to us.
Sure. Sure.
But I know that there are a lot of women, at least in the TV, in TV, who grew up on those comic books that you're mentioning.
Oh,
and
okay.
They're genre writers to this day. Now, they might have not been out in the open the way people are with it now, but I also think that comic books weren't necessarily readily available in the bookstores, which is probably why I wasn't exposed to them as a kid, because I was always at, you know, the kids' bookstores, which wouldn't necessarily have had the comic books in them. And then, you know, Barnes and Noble, and I was always, again, in probably the kids' books section. So,
sure. Yeah, well, there was a time where they were on every drugstore and every stationery store in New York and New Jersey, and you could just grab a comic whenever you felt like it. Those days are gone, sadly.
Which is a bummer. They should definitely get back to those days.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there are issues regarding that are more complicated than we can probably go into here. But, I mean, for me, it sounds like that you very much discovered or got into conventions like when you were supposed to. You discovered comics like when you were supposed to, because now there's just this it is unending, the amount of material out there, right?
Yes. And I think that my experience with working in film and TV, you know, I started in college focusing on editing. And then, of course, you know, the writing was still like knocking at my in my brain, like, hello, don't forget about me.
Sure.
So, but I think doing the editing and the writing really helped, and working in film and TV really helped me write this type of material, because you have to envision each panel. You have to do like all the hats you would have in a film and TV show as the writer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what I wanted to ask you as well, which was very much, what sort of, you know, changes did you have to make in your brain? I mean, you said that comic writing is very different than sort of like TV writing. What gears did you have to shift? Because I have spoken to several people, and I do have friends that either write for TV or produce for TV or make their own movies and stuff like that. And a comic that I helped develop, I remember the person that co-created it with me, David Schrader, who I believe you know.
I do know David.
Oh yeah, I know David. I know David very well. But I remember when we were first sort of developing it, he was like, "Wait, what? You have to do panel one, panel? No. I don't like this. I can't." Like in the beginning, he initially couldn't wrap his brain around it. And so, what sort of like gear shifting did you have to do, or was there any?
Yeah, there is, because in TV, especially, and also in features, you're discouraged from really getting into a lot of detail about what everything looks like, you know, because you don't want to step on the toes of the production designer, the director, the cinematographer. You want to make sure that you're leaving it open for them to do their magic and interpret. So you want to give enough detail so that they're not walking blind into what they need to do, but you also can't layer it in there. So in my scripts, at least, I really get into like exactly what I want to see in the panel.
Sure.
God bless Mariana.
Yeah. Your artist is amazing, by the way, the artist and colorist. We haven't mentioned them yet, but they are absolute. I mean, it's interesting to me because there's sort of like an animation, and hopefully this shouldn't be disparaging in any way, but like Disney sort of look to the expressions of the characters. It's not simplistic like that, but I hope you understand what I'm saying when I say that. But the expressions and the mannerisms and the way that people sort of move in the book, like, very much reminded me of not classic animation per se, but it kind of gave me that feel. Am I making...
Yeah, her work is very expressive, which is great.
Yeah.
This isn't an action heavy comic book.
Sure.
And so I needed someone who could really emote what I was writing.
Sure.
And she was able to do that. She just hit the nail on the head immediately when it came to expressing the emotions of the characters, which is,
sure,
I feel like, is critical to this book. So she does all of the interior work, the pencils, the inks, the colors. That's all Mariana.
Yeah. How did you find her?
So Ryland introduced me to his friend Carol, K-A-R-O-L. And he is a Polish writer, comic book person, and he introduced me to Mariana. So that's how I got that connection there. And she actually wasn't my original artist on the book. I had someone else on the book for a very brief moment that did not work out because they felt like they knew better than I did about what the book should look like.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, that's really funny because, I mean, again, this is the sort of thing that I hear over and over again on the podcast, particularly when it comes to indie creators. They're like, I had another artist and it didn't work out. And so, but you really clicked with Mariana, correct?
Yeah, Mariana and I, and Mariana's been great because she's stuck around for so long between, you know, all the, because there was a little bit of a break between when issue one finished and issue two started, because we had actually signed with a publisher after issue one was finished, but that did not work out very well. And so once I got the rights back, I went full gung-ho into issue two. And so that it was probably about a year ago that I got issue two, that I got the comic book back from the publisher and was able to move forward and get issue two completed and drawn and, you know, get the Kickstarter going.
Yeah, I mean, and as far as the Kickstarter goes, this may sound like a stupid question, but why not just do like issue one and then follow it up with issue two? Why throw the whole sort of kit and caboodle into one Kickstarter right now?
I didn't want to, you know, that was a long discussion. I talked with a lot of people. David was one of them because I knew he had run a Kickstarter, and Clay, who helped me build the page, and anyone that I knew who had done a comic books, my friends at Hex Comics, and I spoke to all of them, and Charlie Stickney. I spoke with Charlie Stickney too, who does White Ash.
Yeah.
And the going theory was that it was better for me to just do both of them together, because otherwise I would have had to do one and then another one right behind it.
Sure.
And that just seemed like I'd be pushing my luck in my mind with the amount of free time I have to devote to this. 'Cause I have a 2-year-old, and I stay home with him right now, so sure. My free time is a little jinky.
Understandable. Right now.
But I also was like, I have these 2 issues completed, and it might get me people coming in more if they see that I have 2 completed issues as opposed to 1 issue. And so I just thought it would be a better buy for your money having both issues together and sure. build more confidence with my potential future fans.
Sure. Yeah. And were there any sort of, as like, were you nervous getting ready for the Kickstarter? I mean, that might be a dumb question too, but why Kickstarter? Why not just self-publish? Obviously, you've got the whole package here. Like to me, everything is like ready to go.
This is very professional. The only thing Carlos needs to do is, once I have all the backer names, is, you know, put them in the book and send it off to the printer.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. You said you had signed with a publisher, and it sounds like you don't want to necessarily say who that was, which is fine. But was there ever any thought of like, I'm just going to, you know, jump ahead and just do it myself? Or what were the considerations?
Mariana and I stuck with this. I'm just trying to see what my attorney said that I can, because I know he I asked him once, like, what can I say about this publisher? And he'd given me some like speaking points, and I don't remember what they were now.
Sure. Oh, wow. You got attorneys involved. Like, that is crazy.
Yeah. One of the reasons we hung on with this publisher for so long was because they pay to make the book. They don't just pay to publish.
Oh, okay.
I don't have the money to pay to make all the books. So like the first issue I funded because I was working 2 jobs at the same time. I was doing The Good Wife and Brain Dead. I was scripting for both shows at the same time. And so that's how I funded issue 1. And then issue 2, I was already staying at home with my son, so my only income at this point is the random residual check I get from my episode of Suits.
Sure.
So we had to take out a loan to do issue 2.
Oh, wow.
Holy cow. I can't keep hitting that well when we're running on 1 income, so I can't publish this myself to get out there. I need the support of fans and friends and family to get this out there, and hopefully with any luck we'll blow up big enough where I get enough money to fund issue 3, because otherwise I probably will have to do another loan to do issue 3.
Wow. And there was no sort of ever consideration going directly to the web, like making it a web comic and that sort of thing?
I contemplated that, and I did talk to a couple of my friends about doing that, but that just didn't feel like the right way to go with this.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, to me, it seems like it would be sort of like the easier, low cost, you know, consideration and get your story out there. But if you want it to be in print and out like as a solid thing in the world, it sounds like the Kickstarter was exactly what you needed to do.
Yeah. And I feel like just making people more aware of it, too. This is a great platform for building an audience.
Sure. I mean, to me, the idea of putting a Kickstarter together gives me sort of like nightmares. It's like, you know, the fact that you're able to do that and just like get it together and get it up. And obviously Clay helped you out, our friend Clay Adams, correct?
Yes. And he has been completely invaluable. I would not have been able to do this without his help.
Yeah.
He's just been my go-to for any and all Kickstarter questions. Yep. And my friend Jessalyn hooked me up with the video on my Kickstarter page, because my dear old Mac, which I'm on right now, it's a 2008, and it has decided that it hates iMovie and refuses to work with it no matter what I do.
Macintosh. I'm a Windows guy, which shocks people, but Macintosh.
I was Windows until I started working in film and TV, and then I had to go to Mac because that's what everyone uses.
Yeah, they're all misguided. I'm sorry. I love Windows. That's a whole conversation. I'm sure people are, creative people out there are panicking right now, but no, it's better. It's better. I'm sorry to hear that about your Mac. So how many issues have you written up at this point?
I have the first three issues. So the first two issues are completely done. Issue three script is done. I have four and five broken down, page breakdowns broken down. And in a super ideal world, this would end up being 15 issues. But I don't know that I'm going to have the money to do that many issues.
Sure. So, I mean, have you broken it down sort of into arcs up to 15 or is like 15?
Exactly.
Gotcha. Oh, wow.
I used to have in my wall in California, I had all these like massive post-it notes that laid out the whole series. So that was where it came up with. Because that was one of the things I took away from working in a TV show writer's room was the way they broke down the story. And it works really great for comics.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. So, I mean, there is definitely a beginning, middle, and end to this. Like, and at the end, do you see it sort of collecting into like, I'm sure you do, just like everybody else, like a giant sort of like graphic novel, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's awesome. So you've got it sort of all planned out and, you know, you have an idea of where you want to go. I mean, while you're working on this, I'm sure you're a creative person, you're a writer. Are there any other ideas for comics that you're sort of like, you know, writing or working on? Or is this just sort of like, I need my focus to be on my 2-year-old and this, you know?
Well, I do have a couple of other things I'm trying to work on. So I think, I don't remember where I talked about this before. It might have been a panel that I was on with Ryland, but I think the way I'm going to end up doing comic books in the future is writing them as a pilot script first, and then breaking them down into comic books.
Oh, why is that? Why does that work for you better?
Because it helps me break it down in a way, and then I can use the pilot script as my guide points for how to write up the script for the comic.
Okay.
Because to me, writing a pilot script is a much faster way to write than writing a comic book.
Oh,
so
that's
interesting. So I can kind of lay out the world in a pilot script and then translate it into a comic book. So my next pilot script that I wrote is about a conflict photographer who, after a catastrophic war injury, starts to question reality.
Oh, that sounds great.
That seems prime for a comic book. So that's what I want to get into next. I've pitched a couple of short comic stories to Friction, and I'm fingers crossed going to hear good news from them.
Oh, that's great. That's
soon.
Great.
I mean, I don't know. You know, you never know. It's still at the pitch stage, so who knows what's going to happen with that.
Sure.
And then I wrote a standalone comic script for Steve Prince's Matador series.
Oh, cool.
And then my children's picture book is being illustrated right now.
Yeah.
And then I have another pilot script that I'm working on about a suicidal young woman who becomes an angel of death for those looking to die with dignity.
You really do have a dark inside. Oh, wow. Those all sound like fantastic ideas. The one thing that I want to say about the look of your book, Marianne, how do you pronounce your last name? Because I'm not even going to
tell. I always say Strakowski. We've actually never spoken on the phone. So.
Oh, okay.
I'm not butchering it myself.
I'm going to say Marianne Strakowska because it ends with an A.
Right.
Her art very much reminds me of Pia Guerra from Why the Last Man.
Yes.
When I was looking at it today, I was like, what is it that seems so familiar? Because I used to love that book. And this very much has the same sort of, the thing that impresses me the most, obviously, are all the beautiful colors and the settings and backgrounds and everything. But the way that the faces move, the way that they interact, the hands and everything. It's just, it's really well done. And it reminds me a lot of Pia's artwork. So just in case you didn't know, I'm giving her an amazing compliment because I think I think Pia Guerra's art on Why the Last Man was some of the best that I've seen or had seen in years and years. So
So, I've been very lucky with Mariana. She's an incredible artist, and I'm just forever grateful that she's been willing to stick with the project.
Sure. Well, it's, you know, if reading, just reading it and, you know, probably being exposed to the script is something that she was probably like, yeah, this is something that I have to devote, you know, time to, because I think you've got a really great idea. I think this thing, you know, could be gangbusters. I could easily see it being developed into like a series. Obviously, you've got all this sort of groundwork laid out here, and I think you've got a really impressive and, you know, beautiful sort of debut project as far as comic goes, and people should definitely throw money at it.
Thank you.
Do they just go to Kickstarter and look up Duplicant, or I keep trying to avoid saying Replicant. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Every time
because of Blade Runner. But it is Duplicant. But is there a direct link that they can go to, or?
It is, but it's kind of long. The Kickstarter made this like super long, wordy.
Oh, okay. So go to Kickstarter and look up the word Duplicant, because that's how I found it several times. Awesome. And how do people find you online?
So I have a Facebook page for Duplicant. So it's facebook.com/duplicantcomic.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm on Twitter and Instagram under Musings by Crazed.
Okay, Musings by Crazed. And you have a website, right? Like
I
your
do,
own website.
Yeah. CarlaNappy.com.
Okay, awesome. Well, Carla, I really appreciate you coming on to my podcast. I love this project. I think it's really great. You've got
Thank you. A
solid book and some really solid ideas. People just go to Kickstarter, look up Duplicant, and just throw your money at it. Like as if if you were trying to pay back your donated or your replacement organ. I think you should throw your money at this book. I mean, it is definitely worth reading and checking out. So congratulations on just having an amazing project.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
You're very welcome. So for anybody who's been listening, obviously we've said the name several times, but we have Carla Nappy on the line. The book is Duplicant. It is on Kickstarter. This is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is Christian Horn. You can check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that wonderful stuff. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. We will be back soon with another episode. Thank you for listening, and we will see you when we see you. Bye.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
I'm doing part-time.
Part-time fanboy.